You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jamie and Jason. This is episode 117, and today we're continuing our discussion from last week with Aaron, who is a missionary. Christian missionary to a Muslim-majority region of the world. And we're really just asking him about his – we've heard about his testimony last week, heard about how he ended up where he's at, and basically wanting to know a little bit more about his evangelism strategy, if you will, and just how to approach Muslims from a biblical and from his perspective, his own experience as well. What is the best way to go about that? As Americans, we're very much interacting more and more with Muslims these days. This is actually a cool opportunity that some missionaries are sent out to foreign nations, and they get to interact with Muslims in their native culture. And then there's also Muslims that are coming into the States and immigrating here. And so it's something where it's not as unusual to interact with Muslims in the States as it used to be, or in the West in general. And so this is why it's a very, very important conversation to have. And Aaron, thanks again for joining us and being a part of this.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It's great to be back.
And one of the questions we ended last time just by talking about one of the ways that Muslims and Christians have interacted in the area you're at right now, and in that debate format, as you put it, is not the best. It's not the best way to share your heart and to interact with them and really understand each other's differences. So a big question I think that I would have is, what are some strategies that you've learned as you've done this now to get to know Muslims and to, in time, bring in the gospel and to share with them who Jesus is from scriptural perspective?
Yeah, it's not to say that debates don't have their place. I think they do. Polemics in reaching out to Muslims has its place in pointing out the flaws and in reasoning and within the other person's worldview. However, one, I don't think biblically it's the predominant approach that's used. And practically, we haven't seen it work as well. I think it has a greater impact on the hearer and the community, doing more of a common ground approach. I will bring up the context of this is really relationship-based. Ideally, any type of content that's communicated should be done in a trusting, loving relationship. So we try to build that relationship, and then obviously dependence upon God. He's the one that opens the heart and mind of all of us for us to believe and have faith in him. So in regards to the content, we do use a common ground approach. That is, we start with similarities between the two faiths, and then we get to the gospel. So it's a bridge. And we do this through telling a chronological Bible storytelling. Now, the stories can be expounded upon and can be used. Sometimes we use it drawn out over weeks or months. But we teach about a 5-minute version for someone that's never shared their faith with a Muslim. And we say, you got 5 to 10 minutes at the bus station. Here's how you can bridge the message to the gospel, right? And we bring up 5 people, and each person represents a story, and it represents a truth, a theological truth that we're trying to communicate through that person in the story. And one other thing before I tell you the 5 people, how you introduce the story is important. Like I said, it's a common ground approach. So bringing up how you're going to tell the story is very important. We've done this on the coast of East Africa for, well, over just about 10 years now. And I would say by introducing yourself this way, you probably have a 95% chance of them agreeing for you to tell a story. And so this is what we do. We introduce ourselves, our name, obviously, and then we say, can we tell you a story from the Torah, Zerbul, and Injil? Now, the Torah is the Torah. You might be able to hear Torah in there. It's Arabic, Torah. The Zerbul is the Psalms, and the Injil is the Gospel. In the Quran, there's actually four books that they believe have been sent down by Allah to mankind for divine guidance. The Torah, Zerbul, Injil, and Quran. Now, of course, as Christians, we do not believe the Quran as divine inspiration, as divine scripture. However, we do believe the first three. So we can genuinely, as a Christian, want to communicate. And obviously, as we tell the biblical story, we are sharing the Torah, Zerbul, and Injil. Now, most Muslims will not understand what the, say, Injil is, right? They probably have never read the Injil or the Torah or Zerbul. But again, 95% of Muslims, whether they're a nominal Muslim or someone very committed to the faith, they know that these books are from God and that they should listen to them. So for them to deny you telling that story, they're basically denying what God has sent down. This is why most of them will say, yes, please share your story. So once they agree to the story, I won't tell you the story, but I'll briefly explain the people and the context. We start with the garden with Adam. So Adam's the first person, and you can probably guess the theological topic we're trying to communicate is sin, how sin came into the world and the devastating effects. Now, again, I said this is common ground. So in the Quran, and of course, in the Torah, in Genesis, we have the story. Most Muslims just read the Quran. There's different reasons why they do this and why they're told only to read the Quran. But within the Quran, there's multiple times throughout the text that the story of Adam and Eve come up. I believe seven different times. So the story is there. The characters are there. There's slight differences in all the five people that I'm going to mention. However, obviously, as Christians, we want to communicate what we know in Scripture. Don't worry about all the little differences. I'll bring some up that they might object to, but the goal is to go through the story. So Adam, how sin came into the world. They portray sin as more of a mistake, that Satan made them slip and they fell into sin. They believe they're in heaven and they fell down to earth after sin. So there's small differences, but obviously the fact that sin has come into the world and it has now affected all of mankind. They also don't believe in original sin. They don't believe it's passed down. So there's definitely differences, but sin and the devastating effects. Then we move to Abraham, and Abraham was a man of faith. Muslims understand that. And we believe it too. And obviously the necessity of faith, right? We must receive faith and trust in God. Another story within that, that they believe something different, is when God told Abraham to take his son, Isaac, to be killed, right? Sacrificed. Well, they believe it was Ishmael. We believe Isaac. So again, it's a difference. What we teach people is, you know, it's a bridge to the gospel. You don't want to get hung up on these things. So we often say it was just a son, right? So you're explaining the story. God told him to take his son up on the mountain. And before he killed him, God provided a lamb, right? A substitute. Then we get to Moses. And Moses represents the law. The law came through Moses, and the people continued to rebel against God. It did not bring them closer to God. It took them farther away as they rebelled and showed their need for something else to save them. And then the fourth person or group of people are the prophets. And Muslims believe in many prophets. In fact, in the Quran, there's 23 biblical prophets mentioned by name in the Quran. And what you're trying to point out with the prophets is the prophecies about the Messiah. So all these prophets spoke about one to come. Sometimes we give specific examples, whether the virgin birth or to be born in the city of Bethlehem. They all spoke about this person to come, the Messiah. And then the fifth person, you probably guessed it, is the Messiah, Jesus. So just like all the prophets spoke, this person came. His name was Jesus. And we talk about his life. Obviously, out of the five people, we're spending most of the time on Jesus. And we're trying to connect to the Muslim minds. Last week, I mentioned that the number two factor in why Muslims come to faith is supernatural encounters with God, whether demonic deliverance or healing or visions, dreams. So it's important, as you're talking about Jesus, the way he had power over demons, right? He could heal people. But the greatest thing that he did, the greatest miracle, is that he died for your sins, and he rose from the dead, defeating sin, the power of sin in your life. So we don't stray away from the death and resurrection. And why I bring that up, not only is it because it's so important, obviously it's the gospel, the heart of the gospel, but that is a dividing point, I believe we talked about last week, between Muslims and Christians. Muslims will say, according to the Quran, that Jesus did not die. It only appeared that he died. Many believe someone took his place on the cross. But again, if they interrupt you in those 5 to 10 minutes, you say, hey, you agreed, we tell the story, and at the end, you can ask questions. So at the end, after we explain the death and resurrection of Christ, we say, do you believe this story to be true? And then we allow them to explain, and then we get an idea of where they're at in the story and understanding the gospel. Even when it comes to the death and resurrection, we're not trying to get caught up on, did Jesus die, right? There's many debates, and Muslims will want to debate that fact. But we're trying to communicate why Jesus died, not did he die, the meaning of the cross, the meaning of the gospel. And that's what the whole story, hopefully, as you communicate it, they'll see the purpose, why they need a Messiah, why he needed to die, for us to be brought back into right relationship with God. So that's really the simplest way that we communicate the contents or introduce the contents of the gospel to Muslims.
You mentioned that original sin is something that a Muslim would deny, but they basically see it as we slipped up, we were essentially deceived, which, not that that's a total contradiction of what we as Christians believe, but certainly there's the passing on of the sin nature, and that we are dead in sin, according to Apostle Paul. In communicating the idea of sin, is there a way that you have found that resonates well with them when that topic comes up, in a way that they can get a hold of and say, yeah, that makes sense now that you put it that way?
Well, I think, like, for everybody, it's a challenge. And it's obviously key to understand the gospel, the need for the gospel. So I don't know if it's necessarily unique to a Muslim, but when it comes to the law, and even in that story, we try to include them in that story. If you're familiar even with, like, the way of the master, Ray Comfort's, you know, how he uses the law and asks them, you know, have you ever stolen something, right? Have you ever told a lie? That's really important for them to realize that it's not small sin, big sin, that every sin is devastating, because they do have that idea that certain sins, you're going to be punished more than other sins in heaven, right? Not just here on earth. Of course, they believe that too. The penalty, say, of adultery is death for the Muslim. It's supposed to be. And not lying, you don't get killed for lying. But in heaven, there's also different punishments for certain sins. And again, it's work-based, so it really depends. I mean, no one knows. That's why they say, inshallah, God only knows on that day. But there's different, you know, metaphors, illustrations that we use. We're often at the beach, you know, and pick up a glass of water, you know, and you put some dirt in that water, Are you going to drink that water? Well, probably not. Now, what if you add clean water into the glass, you know? You add more clean water into the glass. Is that going to help you? Are you still going to drink the water? No. Why? Because there's still dirt. You can add as much clean water as you want, but you're still dirty, right? And before God, he's a holy God. And you need to be forgiven. You need to be righteous before him for him to accept you. So, yeah, there's different illustrations we use. But yeah, I'm not sure there's so much different than other people per se.
One thing that I've noticed, and maybe you could speak to this, when I've interacted with Muslims, they tend to have, and this is not as large of a sample, but they tend to have an assumption that Christians in general don't hold to really what we'd call a biblical morality. I remember talking with a Muslim woman who was surprised. Well, she at first said, essentially, you can be as promiscuous as you want because you're a Christian. And I showed her Matthew 5 and showed her what Jesus said about even lust in the heart and how that is, you're committing adultery in the heart. And have you noticed that as well? Like just that they kind of make an assumption or that they kind of think of maybe Americans in particular as the version of Christian that doesn't necessarily have a high morality?
Oh, yeah, there's definitely that feeling. There's the assumption that the West, because we identify predominantly as Christian, are Christian, right? Now, for a Muslim, you're born a Muslim. So it's not so much like as a Christian, we accept the gift of salvation, then we're born again. And there has to be a time that we choose to make a decision to follow Christ, not necessarily for a Muslim. So they like to clump us into regions or countries that say they're Christians. So then they say everything that's coming out of the West is a product of Christianity. So I've had Muslims, yeah, say, look at the immorality. Look at all the pornography, right? This is what, you know, Christian morality has produced. Or look at the abortion in America. Why aren't the Christians standing up? Right. And saying something, which, hey, yeah, that's a good point. We are. But of course, they're clumping. And even, you know, if you look at a poll, yeah, I don't know what Christians in America are polling at now, but it's really high. And those people aren't walking with Christ. And if you dug into their life, you wouldn't want them to be representing Christianity. So it's very common for even to look at Hollywood in the movies. And yeah, the majority of movies are full of immorality and garbage. So yeah, it's a problem, a challenge that we have to make those distinctions. But it can easily be flipped on them. You know, that whole idea that we're morally superior because we dress better. And even with your previous question in regards to sin, it's a facade to think that just outward appearance makes you righteous. So we often turn it to the inward, just like Jesus did, right? Say with sexual immorality. You know, he said, anybody who looks at a woman with lust, right, is guilty before God. He's dealing with the heart. So we can ask, yeah, you know, your lady's dress may be more honest, because that's one thing, especially young guys will point out. Look at your Christian women, how terrible they dress, right? And they think righteous dress is how they dress, by covering. But then you challenge them, well, how's your heart, right? You can have someone dress head to toe, right? But have you still had improper thoughts about them? Yeah, that doesn't stop you, because it's you are the problem. You are the sinner. And of course, some cases, sadly, in the West, you know, that's kind of the excuse and cry of Muslims. Oh, you know, we turned on this person because, you know, look how badly they were dressing, as an excuse for their bad behavior. So even right now in Sharia, more Sharia compliant countries, if that's the golden standard, why aren't Muslims running into those countries? But you have countries like Saudi Arabia or Syria or Afghanistan that definitely impose Sharia. They're trying to more than any other country, but people are running away from those countries. Anyways, I can get political real quick, but it's important sometimes to throw it back at them, you know, put the ball in their court you want to challenge, you know, Christian morality, let's not just point at, you know, general areas of the world and say that these are all Christians or these are all Muslims. Because quickly what they do is, well, that's just them. They're not truly Muslims, right? The terrorists aren't truly Muslims. And of course, yeah, just because you're a Christian, saying you're a Christian in the United States doesn't mean you're a Christian. It's much more. We need to get into what does the text say, right?
Yeah.
Can they justify their lifestyle from the biblical text? We're also turning it onto the Muslim. Can the terrorists justify their action from the Quranic text? Of course, again, that can be tricky. It can be more hostile. But in a loving relationship, like I'm saying, hopefully you're engaging with the Muslim, can help them think through. And ultimately, that's what we want, right? Them to be in the biblical text, see the truth for themselves, and to study their Quranic text critically.
I like that approach that you're talking about in terms of really trying to set the table in a way that is on their terms, so to speak, without, you know, caving into a false gospel or something like that. That is one of these important things that I've really incorporated it in my own evangelism, you know, my own personal life, just in general across the board, is really asking the question, you know, what evidence will somebody accept? Because otherwise you just end up in that debate, and then the gospel, you don't really get to the gospel, and it doesn't really end up being a positive thing. So that's kind of that's a neat approach to, okay, you accept these texts as from God, accept these specific people that also we then can use to share the gospel. That's a pretty neat approach. What would you say is the most common response? So you've walked through the five and presented the whole gospel. Typically at that point, where do these conversations typically go from that point?
Well, our goal, as after we tell the story, is that it would foster, again, a long-term, you know, Christ-centered relationship with the person. So this, like I said, you know, we call it C2C, creation to the cross. After C2C, we're hoping that, one, we get their contact, and we've made the relationship focused on Christ, and the Muslim understands how much we care about their salvation, and that they would understand this truth that has changed us. That we would continue after, when we ask the question, do you believe it's true? Most of the time, they'll bring up some objection. Like I mentioned, maybe we don't believe that Jesus actually died on the cross, or we don't believe that, you know, Abraham offered Isaac, one of these objections. Or they might just turn the table and say, well, what do you believe about Muhammad, right? And that's kind of going a different way, but we try not to go that direction. Ideally, when they bring up an objection, we like to ask, well, have you ever read in the Holy Book this story? Because we're hoping to get another meeting where we can get more in depth into the stories. Or they'll often bring up maybe a contradiction that they've heard, right? They learn some supposed objections or polemics of their own that they can turn on a Christian. So if they're a little more argumentative, you know, they're going to bring up some objection. And often when they point out a certain objection, my thing, well, have you ever read that story, right? Or have you ever read that passage? And again, most of their objections are solved, they're answered from just reading it in context. But I want them to actually sit down and read the text. So I'm looking at something more long-term, and I turn it back on them. I try not to give them the perfect answer, so to speak, on the spot, because most of the time they're not actually listening to the perfect answer. It's usually a response, hoping to maybe trap me or just deter me from continuing on. So I want to have them see my genuineness, and hopefully we can meet again to dive deeper into these stories. That's, again, one of the reasons we go through the C2C, so that we can continue studying the Bible ultimately.
If I understand it right, so they would say even the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are, in some sense, they would agree that they're divinely given, Would that be true?
Again, most of the Muslims don't know exactly what Muhammad knew of the Injil. And most likely Muhammad didn't know of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, right? We know he had contact with Nestorian Christians during that time because he was part of a caravan traders that went farther north into Syria. So he clearly was coming into some stories about Christianity and the gospel, but he was clearly misguided and didn't quite have the whole picture. So even, you know, Muslim scholars don't expound a whole lot on what the Injil means. One of the most common ideas is that it's all contained in the Quran, so you don't have to worry about it, right? The Quran perfectly brings these texts together, and it's the final revelation, just as they believe Muhammad was the final and universal prophet to all. So the Quran is for all and to all. That's not what the Quran says, though. That's really an interpretation, an attempt to explain why you don't have to read the Injil, right? The Quran says that these books were given by God, right? And they should be understood as being given by God. Another approach is that they'll say those books are just given to the prophet in that specific time and context. That's how they view the prophets, too. I mentioned they believe in many biblical prophets. Even Isa, they believe he was a prophet sent by God. But they believe he was sent to the people of Israel at that specific time, not for all people. Same with Moses and everybody else. And they pretty much make everybody a prophet. Even Adam, they say, is a prophet, or David, or, yeah, many different people, or Job. Muhammad is the universal prophet that everybody should understand and believe in. So it goes along sometimes with the books. They have different ways. But again, the Quran doesn't say that. And it's somehow a challenge. And that's one approach that people use to get Muslims to read the Bible by pointing out these different Quranic passages that put the Quran on the same level as the Torah, Zebul, and Injil.
When it comes to talking about the cross, and obviously this is the heart of the gospel message we have to share with Muslims, from my experience, they will point to passages in the Quran where it says something along the lines of no one should bear the burdens of another, or no one should be the burden bearer of another. And that idea, you know, it sounds somewhat similar to a Galatians 6 passage where, that idea is kind of given in the sense of you should take responsibility for your actions. You shouldn't foist your burdens on others in that sense. But they take it to mean that no one could bear the sin of another, correct? And so that's their, would that be one of their chief objections to what happened on the cross?
Yeah, in regards to the atonement, yeah. Yeah, they do bring up that objection. Sometimes that passage in the Quran that you referred to, right? That each person has to bear their own burden, right? So they have to be held directly accountable before God. So be punished, or how can Jesus be punished for you, right? You have to be punished for your own sin.
And how do you typically turn that around and say, essentially, if you were to bear your own burden, there would be no future, no hope? I mean, is that essentially what you take from that is look, this is one who is qualified to bear the burden for you?
Yeah, that's why it's important for them to understand original sin, the how terrible sin is, and then even the law is showed that we cannot bear our own burdens, right? We can't do the right thing, and how, you know, the sacrificial system was only pointing to one who could perfectly bear our burdens. And obviously the fact that Jesus is divine, right? He is, and his necessity for being without sin too, being a perfect sacrifice who could take on in his human nature with his divine nature, satisfying God's wrath on man's behalf. But all these truths are obviously very important for us as Christians and for Muslims to understand. But it takes time, obviously, because these central truths are at the heart of the Muslim disagreement with Christians. So the fact that Jesus is just a prophet, right? That's one question that they always bring up. He's just a prophet. He's not God. And there are many ways of challenging with that. One of which is saying, where did Jesus say, I am God? They want those words in that order. All these truths are extremely important for them to understand, but it takes time for them. What I've found, it's actually not the truth which is hard to accept for a Muslim, because as we know from scripture, we do realize that we need a savior, right? That we do fall short. However, it's the consequences which are hard to accept for a Muslim. So again, the need to be in that loving relationship, well, what's going to happen when I actually believe something else? Because they're in that system of trying to pray, and it's very easy to show where they fall short, right? Because of the high standard of the law that they're trying to keep, right? A Muslim's supposed to pray 5 times a day. So you ask the Muslim, you know, have you skipped any prayers? Yeah, every Muslim has, right? Well, they have a way of excusing that, and you can make up prayers. But have you made up those prayers? No. Right? So again, it, even, you know, not from the Torah, but even the Islamic law, they're continually falling short on a daily basis of that standard. And even the aspects they're supposed to make up, they haven't made up, you know. Mm-hmm. So again, another way to show how they fall short. But oftentimes they just keep attempting to say that, you know, well, God will know, right? Everybody's a sinner, and we agree everyone's a sinner. That's why we need Jesus, right? Not one person, you know, you show the most holy person you know as a Muslim, they fall short. No one can keep this law.
The largest issue is really not in terms of believing, they recognize inherently, instinctively. I mean, any logical, like you said, any logical person will admit, and you see this even in American culture, everybody's like, oh, people are inherently good. And then you talk to them a little bit, and it doesn't take very long to get them to admit that, well, no, we don't see that played out, you know, in reality or whatever. So that makes sense. How do you help guide, you know, in a relational sense, a Muslim over that biggest hurdle, the consequence of this, prospectively losing their family or their jobs or more dire consequences in some cases? How do you really walk them through that as really, in this sense, you know, a brother or sister in their life? How do you help them get over that particular issue, which I can totally understand why that would be a really tough one?
Yeah, I think one, showing them the worth of the gospel, to show them how valuable the gospel is, that it's worth losing people. You know, we take risks based on what we understand for the reward, right? The value of what we put on something we often make sacrifices for. So they must value the gospel, right? They must value Christ above all else. And of course, Christ talked about that himself. And there's plenty of scriptures to go through. And that's when someone is a person of peace, you know, seeking the truth, listening. We specifically use, you know, passages that talk about persecution, right? And thankfully, the scriptures are full of it. And sometimes I think, you know, the scriptures fit better in that context, in a Muslim background context, than say a Western context. Because the scriptures are full of suffering for Christ. We shouldn't be surprised by it. But then second, like I've been saying, you know, creating a community that is family, which is the church, right? I think a lot of times we have kind of a superficial church idea, maybe in the West, but everywhere. It's just being a one-time event. But, you know, obviously family is there for you in time of need, is willing to suffer with you and to wipe your tears and comfort you and mourn with you and provide for you and do those things if, you know, a good family would do. And that should be the church. So that's what we see in Acts chapter 2, right? They're breaking bread together, right? They're doing life together. It's not a one time a week type thing, but it's a day-to-day thing. So to model that from the beginning is very important so that they can accept the consequences. And I think God has obviously designed the church to help in facing those challenges of life. That's why, you know, like in Hebrews 10:25, which Hebrews is talking a lot about persecution, you know, don't forsake the gathering. And I think obviously with COVID, the verse has been thrown around for a while, but I think in the context of, say, the persecuted church, or realizing our need, or the temptation rather, to walk away from the faith is real, we need each other. So when we realize the danger that's out there, we have to come together. So what we try to do is, think of people, Muslims, all people really, as people that we are, from the time we share C2C or anything about the gospel, that we're discipling them to Christ. You know, when they actually come out and confess, then we're discipling them in Christ, because we need to be there with them and for them from the very beginning. They're disciples of Christ from day one. You know, Jesus didn't run away from Peter after he made himself, you know, a fool the first time. You know, he treated them the same because he was discipling them. So for us too, we need to have a high cost in discipleship. That's the way we usually put it. Of course, there's a cost in following Christ, but there's a cost in discipling other people too. And this came as a reality a few years ago when a brother came from a Muslim background, came to Christ, and he faced a lot of persecution. They tried to stone him, and he believes they were trying to kill him. He was able to run away and escape. And he hid in an abandoned building for some days. He started drinking some of the water that was on the floor, got sick. He said, I got to go to the hospital or else I'm going to die. I have no choice. And after that, while he's in the hospital, we were able to help him go somewhere. And he lived in secret underground for a while at another pastor's home in a neighboring city. And eventually he went back, and he was still facing threats. And I remember talking to him. And while his family was threatening him and to other people, he said, Aaron, I think they might be coming to your house. I know they're upset. And some of his relatives and he himself had visited me. And he was warning me that, you know, I don't know what they're going to do, show up with some sort of weapon or threaten me. They never did. But it made me think, wait, there's a cost to walking with this person. Clearly, he's telling me that. And of course, he has the greatest cost account. But me, the one that's discipling him, walking with him, I also have a cost account. And I think there is that cost for all of us. When we start talking to whoever it is, a homeless person or a prostitute or drug addict or any sinner, right? It gets ugly, right? And we need to not just give a superficial gospel presentation and feel like, yeah, we get a star for that, onto the next one, but be willing to walk with this person however long it takes, and be willing to take on some of their, obviously, their burdens and the consequences of, yeah, just following Christ. For them to follow Christ, it means that we also face some of those challenges. So we need to be willing to count the cost in discipling others.
It's been a great conversation. We'd obviously love it to go on, because I think this is really helpful stuff, just in terms of, as believers in Jesus, we recognize that the call to make disciples is the universal call of a believer in Jesus. You know, Matthew 28 that we referred to in the first episode, Jesus makes it very clear. This is our job as Christians, and we all have a role in that. And so we need to be prepared to do it. So we really appreciate you having this conversation with us. I do want to encourage the listeners, as Jason mentioned in the beginning, go back and listen to the first part, because there's a lot of good, important stuff in there. And also, if you want to find out more about Aaron and his wife, their ministry, check out the links that are in the episode show notes for both episodes, and they'd love to be able to connect further with you there in those formats. Aaron, I just want to give you a final opportunity here. How would you best encourage our listeners, as the, for those sitting there listening, how can they continue to grow in their ability to share the gospel well and to love well their Muslim friends, neighbors, and those in their community?
I think to be optimistic, God is on the move. As I mentioned in the first episode, God's doing great things. So look for God to do great things amongst Muslim people. So be optimistic. Look for places to share. There's many refugees in the area. I've been able to connect with university students, even here in the local community college. There are several Muslim students, and they need a family, right? They need to be loved, and they're willing to meet with people. They need that family. So I would encourage you, get connected to a local college and find out the international students. If you're in a church, take on, you know, caring for some of those students. That's a, it's an open door. God is sending them, I believe, here. We know there's no accidents in his providence, and many people have never heard the gospel or around us. I'd also encourage you, you know, study some. I would encourage you to read the book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus by Nabil Qureshi. I think that's a great book to start for understanding Muslims specifically here in the U.S. It shows his story, how he came to faith. And it's very informative. And yeah, be praying. Be praying in prayer. As I mentioned, God's on the move, right? It's his work. We just want to be faithful, seek him, ask him to do great things, and step out in faith and trusting him.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.